given me a really unique perspective. I've been able to continue doing this even after leaving USA Today, joining Al Monitor, where I'm now Washington correspondent, and also I work at the Atlantic Council, where we put out reports on Iran. We'll have a new one coming out next week on the 20th on Hassan Rouhani's first 100 days, and we'll have an event, and some good people will be speaking, so I recommend that to you. But anyway, I've gotten a good perspective over the years. I started going in 1996, so it's now 17 years I've been going back and forth and back and forth. And Laura, and I do hope she comes, has been covering the P5 plus one talks exhaustively for the last couple of years. So she has the real sense of how the negotiations have changed on the ground. I tend to look at it from a sort of wider perspective in terms of the changes in Iranian society as well as Iranian politics that I've observed over the last 17 years. And for me, what is so exciting about this current period is that there really is, I feel, tremendous incentive on both sides to reach some sort of accommodation, and that hasn't been there before. We have always been out of sync. We've been ready when they haven't, they've been ready when we haven't. The stars haven't been aligned in the sense that the personalities at the top of the various administrations, or at least the presidents, were not always on the same page. We certainly saw that with George W. Bush and Mohammed Khatami. The last time we really had a chance, I think, was back after 9/11 when Khatami was the president and he did a lot to facilitate the removal of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. We actually had direct talks with the Iranians. They weren't publicized, but they were the deputy assistant secretary or deputy foreign minister level on the Iranian side in Geneva and Paris. And Mohammad Javad Zarif, the current Iranian foreign minister, is a veteran of some of those talks, which were quite productive and could have been extremely productive if not for the axis of evil speech and the George W. Bush administration's decision to go after all terrorism of global reach, which meant any country that was supporting any group that was on the U.S. terrorist list, and of course Iran is at the top of that list. So we missed some big opportunities then. That said, Mohammad Khatami did not have the close relationship of trust with the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, that Hassan Rouhani has. And this is the real reason why I feel we are at a very different juncture. I just finished Ken Pollack's book, which is excellent, but it has a couple of mistakes in it. One of them is that he calls Rouhani the most anti-establishment figure running in the elections last summer in Iran. Hassan Rouhani is the epitome of the Iranian national security establishment. He has been part of it in one way or another since the revolution. He's been on the Supreme Council of National Security for 23 years, 16 years as its head. He headed the Defense Committee in Parliament. He's been Deputy Speaker of the Parliament. He's on the Assembly of Experts, the Expediency Council, all these clerical bodies that supervise the other branches of government. So I've compared him actually to Zelig, the character in the old Woody Allen movie who was sort of pops up at all these important moments of history. I mean, Hassan Rouhani was even there for Iran-Contra. He was one of the guys that Bud McFarlane and Ali North met with the cake in the shape of a key and all of the rest of that. So this guy's always been there. And he's got a very strong and trusted relationship with the Supreme Leader. So when the Iranians come now to Geneva and they put down their position paper, it has the full support and backing of the Supreme Leader. There's no freelancing going on here, as we sometimes saw under the Khatami period. So that's really why I've been very optimistic about it. That said, as we see, the negotiation process is not easy. And even though I think a lot of things were pre-digested and prepared in advance, countries can always throw a spanner in the works. Witness France last weekend, which French foreign minister decided to make some really controversial remarks to the press that were sitting there, waiting for any little tidbit to fall. And I hope this is the cue for, yes, Laura to arrive. Perfect timing. Yeah. I have just gotten to the part. I have just gotten to the part, Laura, where I was talking about the French. Yes. And how odd it was for Laurent Fabius to come out and call this a sucker's deal to a room full of journalists who were sitting there with nothing to do but wait for any little crumb that would drop from the table of the P5+1. So I've given the background and why I'm optimistic.
Yes.
And now it's up to you to say what happened and why we didn't get an agreement this past weekend.
Thank you. I apologize for being late.
Does that work?
I mean, some of this we're feeling our way through because unlike the French, the U.S. and the European Union, for instance, have not really leaked as much about what transpired in the meeting and why the French seem to be publicly revealing so many details and why they were. My sense over the past few days, as Barbara and I have tried to feel out what happened, is that, you know, Kerry rushed to Geneva. The other foreign ministers weren't invited. He wanted to close the deal, and it turned out that I think some of our European partners might not be so eager to see the U.S. close the deal with Iran without their consultation. I think Kerry thought they had a provisional draft among the P5+1 that was close enough and that he and Zarif could try to close the deal, and that some of our European allies, particularly the French, felt like all six are equal and all six should be consulted. They should have an agreement on the draft before Kerry and Zarif and with Ashton in the room closed the deal. So between Friday night when Kerry and Zarif met for some 5 hours and Saturday morning, as Barbara said, when Fabius wandered into the lobby where all the media were and said, I object to the text, I reject the text, this isn't our text. And then he started saying they don't like the part on Iraq, the plutonium reactor, the heavy water reactor, and he had something on the 20% issue. It was really quite remarkable, and it gave the Iranians a chance to say, look, I mean, the West is divided. It's not between Iran and the P5+1, and Fabius did very little to dispel that notion. The six, of course, were embarrassed, and despite repeated Fabius interventions over the next 12 hours, the talks went on the third day, Saturday, until after midnight. Usually the protocol is Ashton and then Zarif would come give their press conference and tell you what happened and tell you what the plan is. Instead, the second it ended, Fabius in front of the press says, oh, there's no agreement, we're meeting the November 20th and 21st again. And I mean, Ashton and Zarif made their way to the press conference hall and gave the first joint ever press conference to try to give the appearance of progress. And then Kerry did a very late night, 2:30 a.m. press conference, where he did project a lot of frustration and disappointment. So,
thank you.
That's where we are.
Yeah.
Barbara, how do you think the Iranians reacted to what happened at the last discussions? And what do you think the flavor will be coming back? Do you think we've resolved issues with the P5, and do you think the Iranians understood the French position?
I think there's some disappointment, clearly, on the part of the Iranians. Hassan Rouhani counts his 100th day as ending on November the 26th. That's 100 days from the time that his cabinet was installed. And he wants a deal before his 100th day. He has put all his chips in this one basket. And much that should be happening in Iran domestically has basically been stalled while he waits to see if he can get this deal and can get some relief from sanctions. So I think the Iranians were disappointed. On the other hand, I'm sure it was rather amusing to them that this time the obstruction was coming from the other side and not from them. They have been rather proactive compared. It's also ironic because I remember back from 2003 to 2005 when the French, the British, and the Germans were doing the negotiating with Iran because George W. Bush couldn't bring himself to sit at the same table with the Iranians at that time. And then, of course, the European complaint was that they didn't have sufficient buy-in from the United States. So now we have it flipped, and it's, you know, the French, in a way, getting their own back and for this and Syria and perhaps some other issues as well. So I think Zarif is fairly philosophical about it, and it may give the Iranians a little time to do a little work on their side and prepare public opinion for what they're likely to get from this deal, what they're likely to have to give up. We also had a very good development, or reasonably good development, on Monday. Iran signed an agreement with the IAEA that provides some greater access to facilities that the IAEA has been wanting to visit. Not everything they would like, but it's a start. And so this is beginning to show the transparency that Rouhani promised he would in return for Iran keeping elements of its uranium and enrichment program and nuclear program in general. So it's not necessarily bad. Where it's bad is if it doesn't get fixed next week, watch out for Congress. They're going to certainly come in with major new sanctions legislation. And that could put the Iranians in a position where they have to stiffen their position to react to new measures.
Laura, can you tell us a little bit about the Iraq issue and ARAK issue and how that's playing out now and what the French were really concerned about and what the P5 may be concerned about, if anything?
I don't have all the facts. My understanding from a former official who testified yesterday before the House Foreign Affairs Committee is in the U.S. proposal, or the proposal that Kerry was negotiating with Zarif before the French intervention, the U.S. was asking that Iran not build fuel assemblies at Iraq for the duration of the first phase. And then, of course, the intention is to use the six-month first phase. And I checked with that official, and it is 6 months. They would try to use that to negotiate an end state deal or a comprehensive deal where Iraq would either not ever come online or be converted into a light water reactor. The French say, I talked to a French official yesterday who said, Iraq for us is black and white, you know, it's either on or off, so they wouldn't say specifically what their intervention was, except that the six adopted what the French were asking for.
I see. Yeah. Well, I think we'll ask the audience for their questions right now. John?
Let me see if I can get this thing to work. I'll project.
He can do that.
John Isaacs, Council for a Livable World. The French position, how do you assess that? In other words, were they just being obstreperous, or they had a serious point that really the other five countries should have seen in advance and did not?
Barbara was also meeting with a Western diplomat last week.
Yes, I met with a certain Western diplomat. No, they don't want the Arak facility to be completed. They want it not completed as current, you know, as a heavy water facility. That they made plain, I think, before the P5+1 met. So that should not have come as a surprise to anybody in the room. But in terms of the behavior of Laurent Fabius, I think that is what, frankly, is most objectionable to me, that he said the things he said, that he gave ammunition to all the opponents, not just of a good deal, but of any deal between the P5+1 and Iran. He called it a sucker's deal. Now, what is he going to say when they actually reach agreement? How is he going to eat his words? Is he going to say that the proposal was so improved that it's no longer a... You know, if you've seen the headlines in the neoconservative outlets and in the Israeli press and so on, that's all that, you know, they say vive la France and sucker's deal. So I think that was extremely damaging. And is that payback because Obama left the French out on a limb over Syria? You recall the British Parliament decided not to support military strikes, but the French said they would come ahead anyway, and then Obama decided to go to Congress and then to accept another formula for dealing with serious chemical weapons. Maybe payback for that in some sense. It may be an effort to grandstand and get more arms contracts with the Saudis, the other Gulfies, with the Israelis.
I think they also have an objection with the process, basically. You know, the U.S. thought for all this time, really the ones who can close the deal are the U.S. and Iran. Finally, Zarif, you know, is here and wants to talk to the United States. It was clear in the Geneva 1 meeting in October that Zarif and the Iranians were disappointed that Kerry hadn't come. So, you know, Kerry flew to try to nudge this along. And then, you know, I think, honestly, it would be so typically American, and you could see how we would be genuinely surprised that our own closest allies were not on board for the U.S. and Iran just trying to narrow this stuff. So I think there was an outrage over the process. I understand that Ashton, the High Representative for the European Union, has a huge amount to manage. She's, first of all, supposed to deal with those 28 foreign ministers, but she also represents the six. Somehow she had not anticipated or smoothed that out. Things were moving very quickly. So I think that was part of it procedural, and that partly why we're not hearing more about that is because it's clear the U.S. and the Europeans were embarrassed about why Fabius was making all these problems.
There's one other, this is just speculation, but apparently Fabius was prime minister and whatnot during various periods in French political history when there was a lot of terrorism that was attributed to Iran going on in Paris, bombings, assassinations, and some suggestion that he might have a personal animus toward Iran that others in, you know, the French bureaucracy don't have. I don't know. Whatever it is, I hope he got it off his chest and they can go back to negotiating an agreement.
Yes, over here, please. Can you identify yourself, please?
Sam Cutler, Ferrari and Associates. And let me just preface by saying I'm sorry to throw you guys such a curveball, but Reuters is reporting right now that the latest IAEA Gorlin report is going to show that Iran installed 4 new centrifuges since August.
Four
compared to 1,800 period previous 6 months or 3 months.
Yeah.
So if you could respond to that.
Probably sure. Have Nora. I mean, that'd be very interesting. And also, as I understand from the former official who testified yesterday, part of the first phase agreement, Iran would not install more centrifuges for the 6 months. So
yeah, no, that's that. Iran is already complying with an agreement they haven't signed. So that's very good news.
Craig.
Oh, thank you. Mike Kraft, former State Department Counterterrorism and former reporter. So I've got a two-part question. First of all, Laura, on the Iraq reactor, the plutonium, as I understand it, is much more potentially dangerous in terms of a dirty bomb or counterterrorism weapon. Do you see that issue being compromised or any sort of how that would be?
I'm going to have to defer to people who know more about the. I really don't know
that
much.
Mike,
the technology.
Sure. Look, Mike, the thing is that Iraq is not. If there is an agreement, Iraq will not be completed. Plutonium will never be in the spent fuel. It will never be separated from spent fuel. The Israelis have made it very clear, and here I think their point is well taken, that that facility cannot be. Go online, because once it does, it's far too dangerous to try to destroy it. It would spew radioactive material all over the place. And Iran already has a uranium program. It has enough uranium to make a half dozen bombs if it so decides. So it doesn't need to go the plutonium route. This, I think, is clearly a bargaining chip and will be bargained away.
The issue on that is uranium is usually thought in terms of a, quote, a bomb or missile warhead as opposed to the ad hoc plutonium.
It's under inspection as well.
It's a terrible proliferation risk, and so that's why Iraq is not going to be completed.
And the Russian foreign minister was cited today as saying that the Zarif had signed off on the U.S. plan before the modifications were made. And as I understand, Iran is okay with whatever was done on Iraq. So.
Yep.
Thank you. Mike, we'll give someone else a chance. Thank you. Greg
knows best. Let Greg explain it.
Yeah, please.
No, I certainly don't. I do have a follow-up on Iraq, though, and I infer from what you both just said that the difference between France and the U.S. on Iraq is more on tactics rather than strategy. That is, there's pretty much consensus, at least on the P5+1, that we can't have a heavy water reactor operating as part of following an agreement.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm more interested in knowing how this looks from the Iranian perspective. How invested are they in this facility? What kind of changes could be accepted by Iran without making them feel that they had lost face and taken a big hit?
I have never seen in Iran any massive demonstrations or commentary about how a heavy water reactor is our natural right. Uranium enrichment is something else. That is constantly present in Iranian discourse. So enrichment they will not give up, at least not as a right, as they see it. But the Iraq facility is a bargaining chip, in my view. And as everyone knows who's been following the IAEA reports, this has been so slow. I mean, it was supposed to be commissioned last year, then the beginning of this year, and now they're talking about the end of this year. They've been going so slowly on it that I can't think that it would be a huge sacrifice for them to have it converted to a light water reactor or just mothball the place. In the back there.
Hi, I'm Chip House from the Alliance for Peace Building. I suspect more for Barbara. We keep hearing little rumors that there is blowback from the quote-unquote conservatives in Iran about these initiatives. Do you have any information that I wouldn't have on what may be happening on that front?
My sense is that Supreme Leader Khamenei has been quite outspoken in terms of telling these elements to keep their mouths shut or wait a little. I mean, he is doing a better job containing his hardliners than we are doing containing ours at this time. Iran needs the steel. Their economy is in bad condition. People are really frustrated and fed up. I was there in August, and there's more enthusiasm for Rouhani outside Iran than there is inside. People said, oh, great, another mullah, just what we need. You know, this guy isn't going to do anything more for us than the last one. He's got to prove that he can be an effective leader to the Iranian people, and their opinion counts in Iran. It's not something you can completely dispense with. So that's where the real pressure for this deal is coming. And yes, it's sanctions, but it's also 8 years of Ahmadinejad and the way in which Iran was isolated and his harsh rhetoric and the way in which Iran really did become a pariah state under Ahmadinejad. Iranians want to get out from under this, and the Supreme Leader, I think, senses that. So he's got them contained. You'll see the occasional article in Kahan, which is their Wall Street Journal,
which is very
in terms of the editorial page, you know,
right.
And they have their editor-in-chief will write the occasional nasty article, but basically they're contained, I think.
The Kahan is very close to the old Jalili nuclear negotiating team, and Jalili spoke at the anti-U.S. November 4th rally. I think, you know, there's jealousy a little bit to see if Zarif can close a deal that Jalili didn't manage to do, and I anticipate there could be a problem. As Zarif says, the Iranians are trying to do basically a two-part deal with the first phase and an end state. You can see the U.S. is very focused on the first state elements because there's so much concern about would it be enough for the Israelis, for Congress, et cetera, et cetera. Zarif really needs to get language on the end state in that deal when it closes that lets him go back and say something about accepting their enrichment. The U.S. has made pretty clear they're not going to use rights language.
That's the question.
And I anticipate, I heard there's some nod towards accepting it or something in the preamble. I'm not sure it's enough that Zarif can go tell people that's accepted by what's in that language.
Can I ask a question? I mean, I remember Hillary Clinton in December 2011 basically suggested that Iran could have enrichment if it resolved all its issues with the IAEA and the UN Security Council.
And Kerry made such a statement to the BBC's Kim Gattis, I think from UAE, on the way back, saying they have to be, I'm not sure the French are 100% there.
I mean, there might be a way to hedge it, if they're considered in compliance and the UNS Security Council
caveat.
Then they can have, a limited enrichment program, something like that.
John.
Yeah, Ken Meyerberg, World Docs. Barbara has stated that let me be a little bit of a devil's advocate here. Barbara stated how devastating the sanctions are on the Iranian economy. But I see some evidence that the sanctions are weakening. China and Japan have increased the amount of Iranian oil they're importing. India's had a long time rupees for oil deal with Iran. Pakistan recently signed an agreement on a gas pipeline, a long delayed gas pipeline. Great Britain even has recently opened a gas field in the North Sea that's jointly owned by BP, the National Iranian Oil Company, and has unfrozen certain assets, certain Iranian assets. So I think Barbara has spoken. Barbara, maybe you would like to offer your opinion as to what factor the sanctions play.
In Baghdad a couple years ago, when the U.S. and the P5+1 presented a confidence-building measure to Iran, It was just before those July 1st sanctions came online that really hit Iran hard. The U.S. felt at that point that they wanted the sanctions to go ahead and that their leverage would be increasing over time, as Iran felt it more. And you can definitely sense from the U.S. team the past 2 months that they feel like they're at the maximum point where their leverage can be reached, and they, you know, are urgently pushing for Congress to hold off on more right now, because basically the point of coercive diplomacy, they said, is, you know, you get the country to come and say, yes, we're going to make a deal, and so finally you have this. And so they want to test Iran's intentions and to see if they can close a deal, you know, basically to do what we're asking for.
In front here.
Jonas Plessner with the Embassy of Denmark. I was going to ask about the sort of the new way of negotiating with both Zarif and Rouhani being very active on Twitter, and one of the places where I follow them myself, and how you would see that both on the sort of negotiations, but also more sort of impact in Iranian society, the fact that, well, that social media is curtailed, but at the same time you have sort of different debate. Will that spill over? And then a second very simple question, what's going to happen to 20?
I'll let you do the second one. yeah, you know, it's ironic. I mean, most Iranians don't have access to Facebook and Twitter, but the leaders of the country do, you know. So it's a public diplomacy tool. It's very effective, and it gets to the media because we're on Twitter watching. So if Zarif wants to get a quick, you know, refutation of some argument or a quick crack out, you know, put it out on Twitter. It's exactly what it's there for, and then, you know, we'll all report it.
You saw that when Kerry made a statement in the UAE the other day about, you know, we had consensus and the Iranians wouldn't take the offer. They had like 2 hours to look at the end. Zarif got upset. And
yeah.
It was the first time he went on Twitter and he said, Mr. Secretary, you know, is that how it went? Yeah, no. You saw the Daily Show also making fun of, you know, how did the foreign minister of Iran protest the U.S. statement? You know, did he give a pointed diatribe to State TV? No, he went on Twitter.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And you know, yesterday when Colin Cowell said no fuel assemblies for Iraq and no new centrifuges installed, I put it on Twitter. That's how you communicate stuff now. And if, then when you have time, you sit down and you write a story. But it's a very effective tool.
It works either way, though, because I'll say with Barbara and me, we've had the experience that they report something on Twitter and
it's not true.
Get an email 5 minutes later from the Israeli government or Israeli embassy saying doesn't double the breakout time. It's 0.8 month, and, you know, you're like going back to your charts and asking your sources, and they're all kind of watching each other.
Well, following on to your question, a very basic one, but I think we all need to know, what's the deal look like on both sides?
Okay. I need to write it. So the bullet points are, it suspends 20% for 6 months. It neutralizes their stockpile. I assume they can continue to convert it to oxide. It restricts the growth of the 3.5% stockpile, which is new. It doesn't allow the building of fuel assemblies at Iraq. It increases inspections at Natanz and Fordo. And what am I missing?
No new centrifuges installed.
It does,
right?
It doesn't
repair the centrifuges, but not install new ones.
In exchange for, I was told, $6 billion in sanctions relief, $3 billion in access to their hard currency, frozen assets, and $3 billion in stuff that was in the old Almaty offer, which was
gold,
petrochemicals, and auto stuff.
Auto parts?
Auto and air auto sales, which I think was restricted in one of the sanctions.
Okay,
and
auto
then,
sales.
Right. The Israelis say, and there's been a very nasty dispute on Twitter between the State Department spokeswoman and the Israeli intelligence minister, Steinitz. The Israelis say it's perhaps tens of billion dollars worth of sanctions relief, and they say that the U.S. is using an estimate on six-month revenues versus annual revenues. So, I mean, the Israelis are making an argument that resonates on the Hill of what you were asking before, that there's a kind of psychological arc to sanctions, and once you tweak on the edges, basically, you know, companies will think they can get back in, the fear factor will diminish in Iran and they'll just be less motivated to make a good deal.
Yeah, I think I would dispute that. The sanctions regime is so draconian and the fines levied against foreign companies that deal with Iran in violation of U.S. sanctions, those fines are so high that I don't think major multinational corporations are going to go running into Iran until there's an agreement, a real agreement.
And what do you think, what's Congress's role in approving, disproving, helping it, hurting it along? And also, a related question I have, how does the first initial step relate to the rest of it?
So then you would use those 6 months when Iran is not doing all these things. It's really on the cusp with 19,000 centrifuges, and it could expand its enrichment capacity very quickly without really demonstrably escalating, right? So you kind of hold it steady and even roll it back in some ways, and you try to negotiate an end state agreement for which they would be able to get banking, you know, real sanctions relief after 6 months or a year.
Well, certainly they would get the UN Security Council resolutions overridden. Which are the basis for the sanctions in the world. I mean, we have our own laws. The Iranians understand that U.S. sanctions will be the last to be removed, at least the ones that require congressional action. There's a lot that President Obama can do through changing executive orders and using the national security waiver in some legislation. It gives them a lot of flexibility. But the Iranians have a very realistic understanding of our Congress. And they know that Iran is not exactly popular on the Hill. The question now is, do we get through, let's see, we've already almost gotten through this week, so we have one more week, right, of congressional action. And will they pass a National Defense Authorization Act? This is the bill that funds our military, with or without sanctions amendment being attached to it. And that's what the fight is over. That's why John Kerry and others were up on the Hill yesterday trying to keep that from happening. Congress adjourns at the end of next week for Thanksgiving, and
December 8th, yeah.
They don't come back till. I'm not sure they even come back.
It's 10 days.
They come back briefly.
Briefly. A few
days. Before Christmas.
Yes.
But this is basically the best shot for the sanctions hawks to get another bit of legislation through.
Yes.
Just to follow that point up, if the Senate adopts sanctions next week, impact on the discussion.
You know, there's my Senate staffer friend, Darius Contact, thinks that actually the Senate banking sanctions having a markup, banking committee, could be less damaging, I think, than if they are attached to the NDAA, which Obama has to sign. So, but, you know, psychologically and in terms of tone, I think you would have a lot of people turning to Zarif in Iran saying, look, you know, Obama can't even, he's very publicly going after this, and he can't even deliver his own Congress for 2 weeks. So I think he would come under a lot of pressure. And I honestly feel like the past 2 weeks you've seen Israel, you know, the government of Israel would like to kill this. They want to kill this deal. And I think that they are, they don't want an interim deal. They want to keep the pressure escalating. So it's really quite tense.
Yeah, I mean, I've never quite seen an Israeli full court press like the one we've seen over the last couple weeks. There was a bit of it maybe during Obama's first term when the Israelis were first raising the idea of a zone of immunity and that they might strike alone and so on. But the kinds of comments we've seen coming from Bibi Netanyahu in particular have been really stunning. And they don't want to see any kind of rapprochement between the United States and the Islamic Republic of Iran. I think that's pretty clear. They feel that that's a threat to them. And of course the Saudis feel the same way. And so that's a pretty potent combination of old U.S. allies trying to keep us from reaching a deal.
Thank you. Anyone else? Any more questions for our audience? Well, thank you so much, both of you. You're doing a terrific job.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You'll see an audio of this event on the American Security Project website. Thank you for coming. Thank you.